Today is Tuesday, March 1st, 2022. This is a part three of a Grand Canyon oral history with Ada Hatch. And Ada's name is spelled A-D-A, last name spelled H-A-T-C-H. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Ada. How are you today?
I'm good, Tom.
Great.
Happy the 1st of March.
Yes, pinch and the punch, first of the month, white rabbits. That's, that's good. You got me first. May we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. Yesterday, you told us quite a bit in part two about the lake, about Lake Powell and boating there. I wondered if you could tell us some about how the formation of the Powell Museum in Page came about.
Well, it was organized and going before I got here.
Oh, it was. Okay.
Yeah. But I worked with them in trying to set up a cataloging system, which I had learned from the Museum of Northern Arizona.
Okay.
And so I worked with them along that line.
When you arrived in Page, this was
In 68.
In 68.
Yeah.
Who was working for the museum at the time? Do you remember?
Yes, Marie Galliard.
How do you spell Marie's last name?
G. Galliard. G A L L A R D.
Okay.
And Stan Jones was on that committee on that board. And
Were there others there?
I just remember working with Marie and Stan.
All right. I wondered if Joni Neville Stavely was there at the time, or did she come later?
No, she came later.
Okay. Okay, so Stan and Marie. And by that time, did they have the building where it is today?
Yes, they did.
Okay.
They did.
And they have a boat out front.
Right, yeah.
Which is one of the replica boats made for the 1959 filming of Ten Who Dared by Walt Disney.
Correct, yes.
And so that boat was already out front. Was it on a stand then, or was it just laying on the ground? Do you remember?
I don't remember.
Okay.
Not sure.
Whether it had a roof over it or not?
I think it did.
Okay. All right. Because today, you know, it's on a nice stand and has a roof over it.
Right, yes.
So they get some protection from the weather there.
Yeah.
But
I was contacted by Larry Weiss to start a Glen Canyon Natural History Association and break away from the Grand Canyon. You know, Larry worked here in the Park Service, and he said, you know, we might as well be making money to give to Glen Canyon rather than all this money going to Grand Canyon. And so in 1968, we broke away, and I was on the first governing board with Larry Evans and Gary Scarmazzo and Larry Weiss, who contacted me, and Dave Pape and Paul Zanger and Corky Hayes. We were all on that first group, and we had to set up our goals and a statement of what we were doing and how we would be helping Grand Canyon National Park with donations from what we'd made from our sales of books and all.
Okay, so let's back up for a minute. Can you please spell Gary and Larry's. Can you spell some last names here?
All right. So Larry Evans was the chair of that committee.
Okay.
And then Gary Scarmazzo, and Scarmazzo is spelled S-C-A-R-M-A-Z-Z-O.
Okay.
And then I was on that committee. And Larry Weiss, and that was spelled W-I-E-S-E.
Okay.
Dave Pape, P-A-P-E.
Okay.
Paul Zanger, spelled Z-A-E-N-G-E-R. And Corky Hayes, H-A-Y-S.
Okay, so of these people, which one of them worked for Glen Canyon National Recreation Area?
Larry Weiss.
Okay, and what was his position there? Do you remember?
I don't know. He was right under the superintendent.
Okay. So like an administrative assistant?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think so, yeah.
All right. And the idea was that the Glen Canyon Natural History Association would be a fundraising arm for Glen Canyon National Recreation Area.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
And there probably wasn't, I mean, the Grand Canyon Association for Grand Canyon National Park, the next national park downstream on the Colorado River, they'd been going a long time.
Right.
So right. When the Powell Museum formed, were they part of Grand Canyon Natural History Association?
Yes.
Really? Okay.
Yes.
I missed that connection.
Until 1968.
Okay, got it.
And then we hired Lulu Santa Maria.
Yeah.
And she was the past business manager of the Grand Canyon.
Right.
Natural History Association.
Okay, so you hired her away from the Grand Canyon NHA to run the Glen Canyon NHA.
Well, I think so. I mean, that's what I had in my notes.
Okay, all right.
And then she gave us a lot of suggestions in how to set this up.
Nice.
That she had brought from the Grand Canyon.
Okay. And was that helpful? Because she
yeah,
would have clearly
yeah,
had some
very,
skills there.
Very good.
Nice. And she would drive up from Flagstaff then?
Well, I think she lived here at that point.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure. It's just that she was very active as we started our Natural History Association.
Because I know she worked for Northland Publishing, Northland Press, in Flagstaff for a while.
Okay. Yeah.
But that would have been in the, I think, in the 80s. So
well,
at one point, she would have moved into Flagstaff.
Well, in the 80s, and see, this was 1968.
Right, right.
So that was quite a bit later.
Yeah. So how did it work forming the Glen Canyon Natural History Association? Was it pretty smooth to get going?
Yeah, it was good. We started out in a garage.
Okay.
And then we ended up meeting in one of the Park Service rooms.
Okay.
And then I think we rented a room from the Park Service.
Okay.
And then I was on that board. I was the last member to go off the original board.
Okay.
But we were making good money and helping the park a lot.
Great. That was my next question was what sort of funding were you generating for the recreation area?
Well, mainly from our bookstore,
Okay.
And we had several people like Gary Ladd and all write books and publish them about this area, and they were big sellers, you know, we made a lot of money.
Great. And I would think that Stan Jones maps, et cetera.
Yeah, right. Well, Stan Jones's maps were separate from our Natural History Association.
Well, did he sell them, you know?
He sold them directly.
Okay, so he wouldn't sell them at a retail discount to the museum, who could then turn around and resell them.
No. Uh-huh.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good. I mean, then the whole principle of the associations, now they're all called conservancies.
Yes.
Is to help be a funding arm.
Right.
For the Park Service, whether
right.
it's a recreation area or
yeah.
a monument or a park.
Yeah.
So that's good.
Yes. Yeah.
So for the museum, do you remember who some of the early curators were? And one of them might have been you, because you got them going on a...
I wasn't. Julia Betts was there for a long time.
Okay. Betts? How do you spell her last name?
Yeah, Betts.
Okay. And was she trying to be a curator, but also trying to, you know, work with visitors when they came in to the museum?
I'm not really sure whether she, I might be wrong, she might have been in with the, Jim Stubbs was with the Page Chronicle.
Okay.
And now I'm not clear whether Julia took over the Page Chronicle or whether she was part of the museum.
Or both, maybe.
Or maybe both. I'm not sure on that.
Okay.
I don't have her. I don't know where she is now, or we could find out.
Yeah. Yeah, no worries. So, do you remember the sort of things that the museum might get donated?
Yes. First of all, Marie Galliard had an incredible collection of fluorescent rocks.
Hmm.
And there was a section that you could go and push this light that would turn on this little area of all these rocks that glowed. Purple and red,
mm-hmm.
and green, and then we had a lot of donations of baskets and things like that.
Okay.
I don't know where they originally got them, because they were all part of the museum before I got here.
Okay. And Marie
Galliard,
what was her role? What did she do in town? Do you remember?
Well, she and Roger, her husband, she might have also been in charge of the museum.
Okay.
You can ask Sharon Buck about some of that.
Okay. All right. So she had a fluorescent rock collection. There were
right.
Indigenous materials, baskets, and
And of course, early things from the dam. You know, they had a lot of the building of the dam.
Okay.
A big section of that, and a section of the river runners.
All right.
And then special people would come in for showing, like the Blairs, who had a trading post here. They had a whole room of their things that were on display for a year, and they would trade off with different special exhibits.
Hmm. Okay. And where was the Blair's trading post?
It was where the old Bash's was. It was west of the old Bash's building, and it was there for several years. I mean, the original Blair's passed away, and their son took it over for a long time.
Okay.
Jim Blair. And
and is that B-L-A-R-E or B?
No, B-L-A-I-R.
Thank you. Okay. And that, so the trading post would have come up with the town.
Right.
Because there was nothing there before the town.
That's right.
Okay.
And Blair's had a trading post over in New Mexico.
Okay. So they knew the business.
Yeah. And spoke Navajo.
Oh, great. Okay. Which is kind of a prerequisite if you want to...
Yeah, for sure.
Be a trader.
Yeah.
Out on the reservation, that makes sense. Okay. And so then I would assume that collections would come in of photographs and you know, boat parts and, you know, different things of the area.
Right, yes.
And the museum is still in existence today.
Yes.
Yeah.
Although since COVID, I think it's been closed.
Yes.
But, yeah, it's still there.
Right. And then I mentioned already Joan Neville's Stavely.
Right.
S-T-A-V-L-Y,
I think.
I think it's L-E-Y, but...
L-E-Y,
maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so, yeah.
What do you remember of Joan?
Well, it was... She had a really interesting history of her parents, and she and her sister were there when their plane came in and crashed, and she lost both parents in that accident.
Right, her mother and father were Norm and Doris Nevilles.
That's right.
Yeah.
Stavely, yeah.
And N-E-V-I-L-L-S. And she married Gaylord Stavely. So then she was Joan Neville Stavely. Right.
Well, Norm Nevilles. Now, what were you spelling out?
Right. So, Joan and her sister Sandra.
Yeah.
Their parents were Norm and Doris Nevilles.
Right. Right.
And then Joan married a man named Gaylord Stavely.
Yes.
And just putting that all in perspective, but Joni had grown up at Mexican Hat.
Right.
And was going to Wasatch Academy when her parents died in a plane crash in 1949. And
I thought she told me that she had seen the plane crash.
Yeah, her sister did, but Joni was up at Wasatch.
Oh, her sister did. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Joni was at class that day.
Yeah, all right.
Monday. But so she was instrumental there in Page for a while.
Right.
And was that the museum, or was she part of city government as well?
No, mainly I think the museum.
Okay, all right.
And then she ended up moving to Flagstaff.
Right. Okay. And then recently the Glen Canyon Natural History Association became the Glen Canyon Conservancy.
Yeah.
As a lot of the Natural History Associations picked up the word conservancy. But the mission is still the same, is that right?
Right.
Okay. All right. What else about the museum? Are you thinking we should, you know, want to mention?
Well, I think that's basically it. We take our school kids down and take them through the museum, and they, you know, and give them a little history of Page.
Okay.
And, you know, I would always take anybody that came to visit down to go through the museum.
Okay. All right. And that sounds good. What other changes have you seen in the town of Page?
Well,
gosh, over the last 50 years?
Yeah, basically, in the last 10 years or so, motels started coming in.
Okay.
And we just couldn't believe it. But the tourism was incredible. They were coming to see Horseshoe Bend and to see the slot canyons and
the wave out there, the
yeah, well, yeah,
Coyote
it was
Buttes.
Pretty hard to get to the wave. That took a lot of hiking.
Okay.
And you had to have later you had to have a permit to get out there.
Right.
But it was interesting because some of the people from Europe came in to see Horseshoe Bend and the Slot Canyon, and they didn't even know too much about Lake Powell.
Huh.
And I thought that was really interesting.
Okay. So these things, sort of the local attractions right around Page, were outperforming visitation on the lake.
Yeah, a little bit. Oh, mainly to foreign. You know, buses would come in with foreign people from all over, Germany,
right.
Everything.
And do you think that was driven simply by the fact that these people were on a bus?
Well, maybe. Yeah, it could be, yeah.
And, you know, you can walk them 100 yards over a sand hill, and they get a nice view, and walk them back and get on the bus, and off we go again.
Yeah, right.
I don't know.
But,
yeah, that whole Horseshoe Bend, when was the first time you went out to Horseshoe Bend? Do you remember?
Yes, it was, I would say, probably 1970.
Okay.
And at that point, we could drive right to it.
Okay.
And get out of the car and take, you know, walk 50 feet, and there it was. And
so
we'd go out there and picnic and everything and be the only ones out there.
Nice. So you drive right around the south side of that sand hill that everybody walked over for a while?
Well, yeah. I think we...
Or did you just drive right up and over?
Well, we followed the power lines.
Oh, okay.
And drove right to it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then eventually that was closed off and people had to walk over.
That's correct, yeah.
And then in the last 10 years, there's the big parking lot and fee collection. Yeah,
charging people.
That's right.
Yeah.
And who collects that money? Is that Glen Canyon National Recreation Area that collects that money? Or?
I think it's shared between the city and the recreation area.
Okay, I see.
Because part of it is city and part of it is the recreation area.
Okay.
They make a lot of money there. They've got restrooms out there now too, and
right. Yeah, it's more people, and then you need more services.
Yeah,
and
right.
So then you need to pay for the people that are providing the services, and
right.
It kind of goes on that way. And isn't there talk now about putting in sort of a walkway or a kind of a all the way back up along the rim? Back toward town with more hotel kind of things?
Yeah, well, they've talked about that.
Okay.
But they have put in a walkway from the dam to the overlook where you look down and see the dam.
Oh, okay.
And that's I would say, about a mile's walk.
Mm-hmm, okay.
But that's nice because you can walk over and look and see the river and see the rim. The dam.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Things like that.
Right. And when did the golf course come in? Was that
well,
early on?
Yeah, the first golf course was down below, and the Sharon can give you a lot of information on that, but
okay.
A lot of the locals worked on that to form that golf course. And then later, the 18-hole golf course came in, and that's where you go around and you hit off from the top of the mesa down off the mesa to one of the holes. That's on the last 9 holes of the golf course. But that's
okay. And did you play golf? Did you?
Yeah, I did.
Okay. So that must have been a unique part of that golf course was to, you know, okay, your hole is down there below this cliff.
Right.
And your job is to is to keep that little ball and have it land on the green down there.
Right.
Wind included, so.
True.
Hmm. And, of course, recently the Navajo Generating Station, well, that your husband worked at, as you mentioned, in maintenance for many years, is being removed.
Yeah. When I first came, I would go out there and grade papers and all and sit on a rock, and there was nothing there.
Hmm.
And then they came in because they were talking about putting in the generating station, and I took a ride in a plane with Paul Gutfreund we circled around with an instrument taking the atmospheric pollutants in the sky before the plant.
Oh.
And he recorded all of that.
What was Paul's last name? How do you spell that?
Gutfreund. G-O-U-T Gutfreund. F-R-O-U-N-D, maybe. Gutfreund.
Okay. And he was a pilot?
Well, no.
Oh.
He was out of Georgia somewhere.
Hmm.
And he was hired by Salt River Project to, you know, record this information before they ever built the plant.
So he was looking at air quality before the plant was built?
Yes.
Hmm.
Yes.
Okay. I wonder what the before and after studies or before and during.
Yeah. And I can remember being in that plane as we circled around. I saw the Slot Canyon up above Antelope Canyon. So, and those are the canyons now that you can take tours to go up in. But when I did that flight around, I spotted that.
Uh-huh.
And drove up there in my four-wheel drive Jeep. And I would take my kids up there, and we'd have cookouts. And at Halloween, we would take the boys up and kind of spook the canyon with pumpkins and stuff.
Oh, uh-huh.
And then we'd take the girls, and right before you got to Upper Antelope, was another canyon, and we would take the girls up that canyon and around and come behind the Slot Canyon, and then we'd go through, and the boys would be in there, you know, with the jack-o'-lanterns and scaring them, and then we'd have a cookout. But they, and our fifth graders made a sign, because then other people were coming in, and our sign said, "Please do not deface this canyon. Leave it for others to enjoy."
Oh, nice.
And we would go in there, and Gary Ladd went in there with us with sandpaper from the shop, the wood shop place, and sand out any carvings.
Oh, wow.
That we saw. And that sand, that sign stood up there. We put it further away where photographers couldn't get it in the picture of the original.
Oh, nice.
Slot Canyon, but finally it was washed away. But we used that a lot with our kids. to go up and hike and have cookouts.
Uh-huh, okay. But I'm thinking there were other slot canyons a little further away, a little more remote, that were just as equally amazing, but they were further away and more remote and so harder to get to.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about sanding out the names with sandpaper for people who had scratched their names in the soft sandstone.
Yeah.
And that happened on the lake quite a bit as well.
Oh, yeah. I went out with the trash tracker, and we would go out there with squirt bottles and clean up a lot of graffiti out there. We'd use iron brushes to brush them out. And
wire brushes?
Yeah.
Okay. That's another good tool.
Yes.
But yeah, it's just, it kind of makes you wonder about the ethics of people.
I know.
To see that. Yeah. Okay. So has the air quality, have you noticed the air quality improving since the towers came down?
Yes, I do, because when we used to come into town, we'd see kind of a long gray haze, kind of like in a string going over this whole area.
Okay.
And now you don't see that at all.
Okay.
And we didn't before the power plant.
Okay. Yeah, because there were three very large towers. How tall were those towers?
I don't know.
200 feet? They were impressively
tall. They were. It was quite spectacular when they tumbled them down.
Were you there?
Down was there watching them go down, and they went down kind of every 10 seconds or so. The first one went, and then the second, and then the third. But
okay.
We got pictures of them as they were falling and crashing to the ground.
Hmm.
And then this huge bunch of smoke and all and dust from them crashing down, which all even blew over through over Page and everything.
Right. Yeah. No, it was quite the event. So
yeah.
Just thinking of changes in the town.
Right.
The coal-fired power plant came and went, and
right.
The tourists have come and keep coming.
Yeah.
The water comes and goes in the lake.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yes.
Is there anything else about the changes in Page that you're thinking about?
No. Like you say, just our town is still growing a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And the tourists are starting to come back. You know, during COVID and all, there were no tour buses or anything.
Right.
And so that's starting up again. But I think with this really low lake level and all, it's going to be a long time before we get back to where we were before COVID.
Right. Right. And COVID may be with us in one form or another.
That's right.
Moving forward, so we'll have precautions and we'll be all right. And
Yeah.
Yeah. But it is interesting, everyone's looking now at water management.
Yes.
In the West, and of course Page gets its water directly from
the runoff in Colorado. Yeah.
Yeah, the runoff in Colorado that comes down the Colorado River and gets trapped there in Lake Powell behind Glen Canyon Dam.
Right.
And as that water drops, then the intake for the city has to follow that.
That's correct.
The piping goes further, deeper and deeper.
Yeah.
And then, the whole new marina at Antelope.
Oh, that's true. Yes. None of that was there. Yeah.
Yeah. And now they're talking about a pump-back storage project on the Navajo side of the lake there to pump water up to a reservoir and then run the water down through turbines back to the lake. And so during the day when there's a lot of renewable energy, you can use that energy to pump water up to the reservoir. And then at night when there's less, you can get that water that you pumped up earlier in the day to release its energy back to the lake. And so it's
that's interesting.
And a way to, it's kind of like a big battery made of water.
Wow.
And so there's much discussion about that happening up lake a little bit.
Who's going to be doing that?
I'm not sure. Clearly the Navajo would be doing it with an independent contractor, I suppose. Yeah. So, and that'll be, more jobs and
that's good.
Which is good, and it'll be more impacts to the land, to the landscape, which has problems. And so, just always trade-offs and ways to look at things. Yeah. So, is there anything else you'd like to bring into this interview?
Okay, I'll bring in one last thing that I thought about. That summer out on Paiute Mesa where we were excavating that ruin, we three girls worked in the Shade Ramada back at camp, and the boys would go out to the top of the mesa for excavating, and then they would come in and bring bags of potsherds and things like that, and then we would take them and scrub them in hydrochloric acid and things like that, the sherds and everything, and catalog them. But the boys all knew that the only thing I was afraid of were mice. I mean, scorpions or any of that other stuff, no big deal. Well, they sent a sherd bag down with a dead mouse in it. And we dumped it out to process it and saw the mouse, and I couldn't believe it. And so we decided to take that mouse, and we cut off its tail, and we scrubbed it really good with soap and water. And then we took it, and we stuck it in Steve Hayden's toothpaste tube.
Oh, my gosh.
And so that night, usually we girls went to bed before the boys, but that night we stayed up because we wanted to hear when he would brush his teeth. Nothing. So the next morning we were the first ones up because we figured, well, maybe he doesn't brush his teeth at night. Nothing the next morning. 2 days later, we hear this scream. And Steve comes running into our camp and dumps me out of my cot. And apparently he'd been brushing his teeth, but there was a groove in the toothpaste that was coming around the tail. And so he'd had 2 days of brushing his teeth with that tail in his toothpaste.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So, but, when they came in that first night, this mouse was hanging from the bush where they parked the Land Rover, and it said, "I am a mouse. I have no tail. Where is my tail?"
Ooh.
And so.
So you gave him a hint even.
So 2 days later, out came the tail.
Oh, my.
So basically, that's my life of the last 80 years.
Well, it's been a lovely life. It is a lovely life.
It's been a great life. Yeah, it has.
Yeah. Nice. And I really like that, like your thought that, it was 35 years to meet Jim. It was 35 years with Jim. Now you're on the 35 years after Jim.
And, that's right.
And, so that's 115. So go for it.
I will do that.
That sounds,
I will do that.
That sounds
and I
great.
Hope to meet you up here in
I look forward to that.
I've
got some work to do with Gary Ladd and Kern and Cindy, and so I really look forward to getting a chance to visit with you when we're up there.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Well, Ada Hatch, thank you so very, very much for a lovely interview series. Do you have anything else to add, or are we good?
No, I think that pretty much covers it all.
Great. Well, this will then conclude our oral history series with Ada Hatch. Today is March 1st, 2022. My name is Tom Martin, and Ada, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.